Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode of the ACT podcast, we are speaking with Michael Ibarra, Chief Data Officer at Eligo Health Research.
Michael has more than 20 years of experience in clinical research and development, and his interests include regulatory and policy implications for digital healthcare. Before joining Eligo, he was the head of digital healthcare for CDISC, which is the Clinical Data Interchange Standards Consortium. And Michael has experience as head of business development, coordination and innovation, and also head of pharmacovigilance innovation at Pfizer, where he was for 15 years in various positions. So thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you again, Michael. So first off, can you describe your career journey for us?
It's circuitous route, but I've always been, you know, one of those guys who would take 3 hours to program something to solve a problem you could solve in half an hour. So I've always been interested in tech and the problems it's solving. And early in my career, I sort of wandered around physics and philosophy and different things, landed finally with a PharmD degree. And from there, I had to choose a fellowship between research and drug development. And I chose drug development, frankly, probably, as I recall, because it was in North Carolina and the weather was beautiful. It was a wonderful fellowship with then Burroughs Wellcome in University of North Carolina. And that launched me on my pharmco career. And after my fellowship, I wandered over to this small company called Quintiles, which was starting up there. And I was writing up the integrated summary of safeties. And my boss came in and said, "Who knows something about safety?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing the ISS." So I went to the meeting and talked about drug safety. And that's basically how my career got started in pharmacovigilance. And I stayed in that for several years, working to try and bring technology to improve it. And then was consulting for a small company who hired me to be the head of pharmacovigilance for them and also head of clinical research. So I stayed with them for a few years before being recruited over to Pfizer, where the bulk of my career was spent. And at Pfizer, after several years of my career there, I got a hold of some healthcare data. We started using EHR data, and I realized I have no idea what this data is. I didn't understand it really, and I had a very different picture having been in on the pharma side for so long. And that got me hooked into using healthcare data for clinical research. And I've never really left that space. I stayed in pharmacovigilance for the bulk of my career at Pfizer. After I moved on from there, I went to CDISC looking at the standards that apply to digital data and consulted there. But after that, during my consulting, I ended up at Eligo consulting for them. And that's where I joined as the VP of Safety and then Chief Data Officer, sort of expanding my career to where I thought it made sense in terms of the changes that were happening in healthcare. I wanted to sort of play in that space, and it's what excited me the most, the interface between technology and using digital healthcare data to improve clinical research. And that's where I've been the last several years now.
I want to tease out one thing that you said. So when you saw healthcare data, the EHR data, the first time, and you said, "What is this? Is it because it's so different?" Or what was...
Sure. It's very different. What I used to say is to get my colleagues to understand is healthcare data is data used to treat patients. And in the pharma industry, our data is used to submit to regulatory authorities. So you cannot take healthcare data directly and use it to submit to a regulatory authority. For example, I was in pharmacovigilance. In pharmacovigilance, when you report an adverse event, you have a clear start date and a clear stop date. And you know, you have sort of an assessment whether the drug in question caused that or not. When we went to look inside the EHR, we literally couldn't find a single start date or stop date. There were many in a sense, but you had to interpret things because it mattered less when a doctor was seeing a patient when exactly to the day that the adverse event started. What matters is that they're able to treat it and improve it and figure out what's going on with it. So the way the data is collected in a time series fashion and the degree to which it's collected is very different than the sort of regulatory rigor that we need to submit data to a regulator for pharmaceutical research. And that has been a stumbling block, I think, for the ability to use healthcare data for clinical research for ever since I got introduced to it, I think.
That's a really good explanation. I was typing that down while you were saying it. So thank you for that. It is one of the hardest things, mapping that data, I understand.
It is. And the way I try and describe to colleagues that aren't aware of it is, there's, you know, the field of informatics has to do with looking at the structure of the data and how you use it and how it's mapped and the model you use and things. The distance between taking healthcare data and then submitting it to a regulator is wide. And what's filling up most of that distance is what I would call the informatics layer. And that is where you need people that understand both the clinical domain and data science in order to bring that data into a state that can be usable. And we've made tremendous progress over the last 5 years in this area. So you'll hear the term regulatory ready data or a regulatory clean data set, things like that. That means that a lot of time has been spent cleaning up that data to make it usable to submit for a regulatory submission.
Awesome. So, I mean, I could literally talk about that piece for the rest of the podcast, but we're going to move on. can you elaborate on your work with the Aster project and iSpy?
Sure. Aster was the culmination of my introduction to healthcare data. And as I got into it, after a year or so, I found myself wondering, what would pharmacovigilance look like if, let's say, 70% of healthcare data was digitized, if we could get our hands on it? And that led me to come up with an idea that one of the great problems in pharmacovigilance at that time was in the spontaneous reporting system. People just didn't use it. That's where anybody could report an adverse event, and doctors never used it. And we always bemoaned the fact that they wouldn't fill out the form, they wouldn't submit the adverse event. So I was talking with David Bate at Brigham and Women's, and I said, David, what do you think about this idea? And he said, this is an interesting idea. We should try and pay attention to it. So we formed a partnership with Brigham and Women's and Pfizer and CDISC using some of their standards. And when a patient came into a doctor's office and the doctor discontinued the drug, and the reason was because of an adverse event, we had a program that went out and captured the information from the medical record, from the EHR that surrounded that event. And we turned it into the proper data standards that FDA needs. And we did some auto coding of the events there. And then we sent it electronically to FDA. So Aster was the first time that we automatically captured adverse events from an EHR and sent them electronically to FDA. And it was a technical great success and a commercial complete failure. And that is what introduced me to this phrase I coined, the pharmaco-regulatory vendor complex, meaning it's very difficult to get innovation in this sprawling industry because you have three sort of components at equilibrium. And when you push on one, the other two sort of tend to settle back in. So Aster was a technical demonstration to me that you can do it, that it's feasible. And technically, it wasn't that hard. But it also demonstrated to me that I needed to be paying attention to the environment in which innovation happens and how it happens. And it really set me off on the next 5 years of my journey, understanding from the vendor point of view, from the government point of view, and from the industry point of view, what is needed to really make change when you're trying to use healthcare data. The iSpy work that I did was after I left Pfizer, I was consulting, and through friend of a friend, ended up over working with UCSF on their iSpy program. And that effort was looking at more on the healthcare side and how can you bring healthcare toward regulated research in order to provide data in a more palatable way. And my work mainly was focused in pharmacovigilance and looking at, when you look at oncology and you look at the designation of toxicities and adverse events in oncology, it's arcane. And you spend a lot of administrative time on that. And I was looking at the ability to satisfy what the clinician needed to do, but make it simpler for them so that they could move data over to clinical research without as much administrative burden. And so that sort of capturing the data to make it usable for clinical research in a regulated fashion, and then making it easier on the healthcare practitioner in order to do that, that's basically been the focus of my career ever since.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that way that you said, you know, that was the opposite shift, looking at the healthcare data to make it more palatable to research. Very interesting. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Michael. So back to the first question I asked, you know, when you were highlighting your career journey, you've obviously been in the digital healthcare space for quite some time. So can you outline the evolution of digital healthcare across clinical trials?
I think for anybody looking at this, I did have a period of time when I was at Pfizer and I had a chance to sort of do an in-company sabbatical for a while. And I read everything I could get my hands on in terms of what happens when you digitize an industry, basically. And when you go back and look at banking, publishing, the music industry, they all follow the same pattern, which at a very high level, you know, is you digitize the data. Eventually, what happens is you start getting new types of business models. There's a gentleman named Ronald Coase, and there's a phrase I talk about with Coasean economics, which simply says that transaction costs are the way that we do business through transactions. And if the costs are high, it's difficult to innovate. Well, once you digitize data, the cost of doing a transaction, let's say your banking transaction, when you digitize it, you can use a card at a teller that the cost goes way down, and that allows you to come up with new business models. And when you go across music, publishing, banking, you see the same thing happen. You digitize the industry, the middleman basically goes away and new types of business models emerge. It's my contention that that's where we are finally at with clinical research. I believe that it took so long. The curve is the same, but the time to get to the inflection point is longer because we're a highly regulated industry. So for a long time, people have been prophesying this would happen, and I have as well. And it's been so slow. It would have been easy to give up. But I think just in the last few years, what we've seen is it's reached the point where there's enough digital data floating around from healthcare and clinical research through many various means, EHR, sensors, patient reported outcomes. And the technology has evolved to the point where, to coin the old phrase, the software can sort of eat the world now. It can eat the world of clinical research, that what we'll see in the next few years are more new business models and more changes and improvements in clinical research than we've seen in the last five. That's my personal opinion about it.
So as you mentioned, you know, we're in a highly regulated industry and, you know, we're reading a lot about FDA. I mean, we know more about FDA, but like using AI and machine-based discovery for various things like adverse events or drug discovery, even I think, you know, FDA has guidance on that kind of thing. So where are we with using AI and understanding it for specific uses in clinical trials?
I think that we are at the very, very beginning. And there's a phrase, an old phrase that people talk about, the future is here, it's just not widely distributed yet. I think depending on who you talk to and what you look at in particular, you'll see amazing things done already. But then in other cases, it looks pretty much status quo. And on the regulator side, the regulators have a tough job. You know, they need to reconcile the past with all of the guidances and regulations that have gone before with the present and where we're headed. And when I was in pharmacovigilance, I experienced this directly with social media. When social media came to the fore, the big question for pharmacovigilance was, do we collect adverse events from social media? And my simple answer was, sure, why not? But what it required was we needed to change our definition. It was difficult to prove that something was an adverse event necessarily. So maybe we should have a new category of to be determined, but we could collect them and look at trends and things like that. That caused a tremendous amount of consternation at the regulators because, understandably so, they were worried that they were going to get completely overwhelmed with work. And in fact, at the companies, that was the same problem. What bothered me was the question we were trying to address was, is this going to cause us more work rather than is this going to improve how we find adverse events? And it's understandable, but it's a typical question that FDA faces since they're typically understaffed. But the point is, it required a new way of thinking about things in order to take advantage of the data and of the technology. And I think we're in exactly the same place with AI, which is a blanket term. It can mean many different things and it has different things under it. We're at the same place with AI and clinical trials. And FDA is struggling with this. They're attempting to address it. But the concepts that you need to understand it are often lacking. One of the things that always bothered me in talking to FDA about social media and data was that most people had this metaphor of a piece of paper in their head. When you report an adverse event, you used to write it down on a piece of paper. So there were certain fields on there and there were certain sizes. And that's literally how they designed the databases. So when we first gave them an adverse event that was just data, we sort of overran all the database limits. And eventually you fix that. But at first, there's a temptation to limit the database, which you can submit, because it's a pain to try and change that. It's the same sort of thing with AI and clinical trials today. We're using, a lot of times, I think, the wrong metaphor in our head when you talk about, for those that have seen ChatGPT and large language models, you literally have to play with them and try it out to understand how it really works and what you can trust and what you cannot. And we need more people to be able to do that, to then start to look at the clinical research domain and understand how it can best be used there. And that's the area that excites me the most today. And it's nothing new in the sense that it requires clinical domain experience and it requires understanding the technology. It's just that it now can be applied to the clinical research process as a whole, I think. And when you do, the results are going to be tremendously powerful, I think.
And great. Thank you, Michael. So I think that maybe you may have answered the first part of the question that I wanted to ask in regards to where are we right now in regard to AI and EHR, but, you know, more specifically, where do you think we're going to be with that in 5 years?
I know it's easy to say, well, there's an old proverb or something, prediction is very difficult, especially about the future. So I have made predictions my entire career. I think I can get them right, but I'm usually very wrong about when they happen. They happen later than I think. But with this, I have to say, I believe that just what you've seen in the last year since the release of ChatGPT, and you see its applications in so many different places, I truly believe what Andrew Ng said about AI several years ago. He said, AI is the new electricity. And some people are very concerned about it. Understandably, I have some concerns, but we have to do something with it. We have to try in order to see what we can do. So where I think we're going to be in 5 years is we're going to make mistakes, just like with the adoption of electricity. Unfortunately, some people will get electrocuted, I think. There's no way around it. To form an engineering discipline, you're going to have to figure out how to get through things in the best way, but still you're going to make some mistakes. But I believe we'll be figuring these out over the next 5 years because the advantage and that we get from the application of this is so great. I believe that the first area of application, especially for large language models, is going to be improving the patient experience in clinical research and improving the communication with them and the efficiency and frequency with which you can do that. Because basically you can scale a conversation now in ways that you could never before. And you can feed it specific information that you want the patient to have, that the patient can converse in a natural way with a chatbot. Now, does it work completely now? Not yet. We're actually trying to do that now, my team, but it's certainly doable. It's an engineering task. It's not theoretical. So I think that in 5 years in a clinical research program, you're going to be able to have a lot of your questions answered without waiting for anybody. You're going to get advice on the particular trial, and that's going to scale. So you can include thousands more patients typically in a trial. Also, I think that, there's many areas of application that people are working on today. On the healthcare side, obviously, they're working on this with EHRs to make data more, to surface the ability in the data to answer questions. So you're going to see large data sets become more usable, I think, to users who don't need a data science degree to figure it out. And so going back to that idea of getting rid of the middleman, as a clinical user, you're going to be able to ask questions of the data that could get answered directly by the technology rather than have to wait for somebody to write a report to give it to you. So I think in certain key areas, the speed with which we can do things is going to be much greater. And the ability to communicate and scale communication in clinical trials, I think, is going to be very different than it is today.
There's a lot of concerns about AI right now. You know, that's what the Hollywood strike, the actors strike right now is literally around that, using AI, not nefarious, but, you know, it can go astray. So where could AI go astray, or what should we be aware of?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The actors strike is a great real world example of it, right? I mean, if there's a profit motive, you can try and replace folks, and the folks who get replaced the first are not the manual labor people. They're the ones that have been writing things. with the new sort of large language model. So that's a real concern. And if you look at clinical research, it's less a problem of replacing than it is augmenting. But the problem with it is the sort of fundamental problem with large language models right now, for example, we have to be much more careful. We can't let a large language model give bad advice to a patient. So if you've used them at all, you know that they do something called hallucinate, or people have said that they confabulate. It's not that they are trying to, that it's just a human term put on it. But what happens is they can sometimes put together information that sounds very convincing, but is not true or wrong. They might give you references to journal articles that don't exist, or they'll say, as said by so-and-so, and they've never said it. This doesn't happen frequently, and there's ways to solve it. And this is why I say we have to keep working on it and improve it. But in fact, one of the concerns is if you don't know what you're doing and you try and use a large language model to have a patient interact with it, then there's a potential that it will hallucinate or confabulate, and then that's going to cause great concern and possible harm there. So in general, just like electricity, I think there's dangers there. There's also the, you know, what's been around for a while is this kind of algorithmic bias where, depending on the data that you fed it, it could draw conclusions based on that data. And if the data is biased, then the conclusions sometimes are biased as well. These are well-known problems, and people are working on them daily as we speak. I think the point here is to proceed with caution, but that we must proceed. What concerns me the most is that we'll use that as an excuse not to move, rather than moving with caution and trying things out in order to reap the benefits of what's here. Because I really think it's going to be a great benefit to anyone that wants to do clinical research. And we don't have nearly as many patients in clinical research as we need to. It reminds me of the old pharmacovigilance problem, where we complain about the problem and we have a solution in front of us. It's going to take hard work to get there, but it's not an excuse that there's a danger of using it, not to try it, I think. So there's real concern and dangers that are possible in the application of different types of tools of AI, but I don't believe that that's a reason that we shouldn't continue with caution.
Excellent. All great points. Thank you so much, Michael. I learned so much. I appreciate your time.
I'm happy to do it. This is all I do. Just run off at the mouth.
Well, it was helpful. You can run off your mouth all you want. It was extremely educational. I'm sure the audience is going to get a lot out of it. So thank you again.
Absolutely. This is great. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yep. Thank you, Michael.